right, folks, welcome to this episode of Beyond the Resume with one of your hosts, Chris Tapa, and your other host,
Lisa Flicker.
Happy to
Thanks
have
for
you
being here.
Here. Yeah. Happy to have you here. We have an interesting guest today. Great guy, Sam Hales. Sam is the CEO and the founder of the Saratoga Group. He's based out of Tennessee, and they are a mobile home park owner, operator, and investor. Great asset class. We've had a couple of mobile home park investors on this podcast years and years ago, but it's been a while. So it was great to see where the asset class is today and all the good work he's doing.
Really love what he's doing. I feel like there is such an impact on the housing that he provides. And, you know, and you guys will hear as you listen to just hearing about like how the care he takes for the young people who are coming and going from those mobile home parks and making sure they don't feel like there's a stigma attached to living there is just, it really, I don't know, it affected me. I thought it was nice.
Yeah, it's great. And we do a lot of, we spotlight a lot of affordable housing, capital A affordable housing owner, operators, developers. But this is another form of affordable housing that a lot of people in this country live in. There's a ton of NIMBYism against this asset class. And I've actually had people in my own world and my family have moved into mobile home parks. And
its stigma,
at least for me, has definitely gone away. So hopefully that is happening across the country because it is necessary for people to have safe, clean places. And there's only so much housing that the government can assist with. And this is non-government assisted housing, right? So it's, people own generally, oftentimes own the home they're living in. They rent the pad. And so there's a lot of pride that goes into the home ownership in the communities. And so with that, as you can tell, we have renamed the podcast. Lisa could not take it anymore with that last name, so she forced me to rename it, and we love it. And because I think it explains more of what we're doing here. We're trying to show folks the different career paths within the real estate world and how people got to where they are and the companies they've been building and the careers they've been building. So, beyond the resume, welcome and thank you again for listening. And please share with your friends, your kids, your colleagues, and if you have any questions or comments or want to see anyone on the podcast, please reach out to us.
Everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good one. Bye.
So, Sam, are you in Tennessee?
Yeah, Chris and I were talking about that. So I spent 20 years in Northern California, came out of Tennessee 2.5 years ago. So
tell us about, like, we've done podcasts in the past with the mobile home park owners, okay. Operators. It's obviously it's niche-y. It's a form of affordable housing. It seems like a secure investment. Like people are always going to need that. I actually grew up in a town called Long Valley, New Jersey, where we had like one part of it. We had McMansions all the way through mobile home parks.
Interesting. Yeah.
And like, it was a pretty rural place in New Jersey. So you just had like space. And so what does the landscape look like now? I know it's become more of an institutional asset class with, you know, Blackstone got into it, some other folks. And like,
that's right.
Is it harder to get deals done?
Well, here we are. It is way easier today than it was 3 months ago or 3 years ago. So it started to get really interesting again, just in the past literally 3 months. I think that's probably similar to multifamily and, you know, some other asset classes as well. Definitely there was a ton of cap rate compression with kind of the consolidation, Blackstone, Carlyle, lots of other private equity, Wall Street money coming into the business. But they also play in a little bit different sandbox because, like what we do, we go buy communities that are, I'm going to say 60%, 65% occupied. That's like our average. And any of that big Wall Street money, they're not looking for that. They're looking for something that's totally stabilized. You know, we kind of use like a star grading system. We're playing in the 2 and 3 star grade, and they're really looking at the 4 and 5 star where you've got pickleball courts. Gotcha. And tennis courts and people drive around on little golf
yeah,
carts
yeah,
and
yeah.
stuff.
Like the one in Malibu, that one?
Yeah, yeah. That's they love that stuff. I look at that and I'm like, how do you create any value? I mean, you're not. You know, it's not. It's just kind of a long-term hold in that case. We like to hold ours long-term as well, but we're looking for places where we can kind of pull some levers and add some value.
They have those, and then where are they located? It's like any other asset class, right? I'm sure like the ones on the coast, right? Generally are like the, you know, more expensive ones. You go inland and it's kind of
secondary, tertiary
markets. And
that's right. I mean, because you can kind of look at, you know, let's say apartment rents or 3-bedroom home rents and you know, you can kind of judge where your mobile home lot rents are going to be kind of based on that. But in terms of quality, you can have really nice quality, institutional with the clubhouse and the pool and all that in Wichita, Kansas,
right.
as well as, you know, some in 300 and 400 and 500 spaces. So, there is kind of quality, you know, in many different markets, but we have some that have, you know, those kind of sizes and have those amenities, but, we don't focus on that. So we like, you know, 100 space park that maybe doesn't have any amenity when we buy it. And we'll typically go and put like a children's playground in, like a nice playground and stuff like that. And people really appreciate those amenities, where if you're a 4-star park, it's like, I'm not gonna say they don't appreciate it, but they just expect it. Like that's, you know, right. So it's not like, hey, happy day. It's more like the pool. Hey, it's May 3rd. Why isn't the pool open yet? And it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
How did you get into mobile home communities? It's such a niche sector.
It is. And I have to admit, I feel super great. I feel very grateful to be in this space because I've done a lot of other things in real estate. I actually started out in tech in the San Francisco Bay Area. But did a whole bunch of single family home investment back in like 2007 and 8 and 9. On through like 2017, basically with a single family. Also did, you know, industrial, did a boutique hotel, did a lot of land development. And then I found out about mobile home parks, in 2016. And really started to look into it in 2017. Bought our first park in 2017. After a few weeks of owning, I was like, we are selling whatever else we can, and we're focusing on mobile home parks. And from that moment on, that's all that Saratoga Group has done. And so we now have 106 communities. We're in 17 states. And,
dang,
you know, got a team, like you know, obviously a team that's helping manage and make all this happen.
It seems pretty labor intensive, right? It's as far as the management's concerned. Mm-hmm. Like it's a lot of like, and also like, are they coming in? Like, are they buying are they just renting the pads from you and then buying their homes, or is like what's your kind of structure?
Well, yeah, that's where that's where the rubber meets the road, and things get, you're right. People used to have this impression of like, hey, it's like owning a parking lot and you're renting out parking spaces. No, it's actually a lot of work. Now, once you get a community filled up and they own all their own homes, then it really is easy to manage. But it's hard to get there. It's pretty intense. It's kind of that process of getting people to own their own home. So yeah, and you're right, Chris. They're not bringing their homes in, but for the most part. I mean, it'll happen occasionally. We love when it happens, but pretty much we're buying the homes, we're setting them up, we're staging them, we're marketing them. People come in, they get qualified, they buy it. And that is, you know, you can imagine you've got 100 lot community and 40 of them are empty. You're bringing in 40 homes. I mean, you're like a home builder almost, right? Because even though homes built in a factory, you gotta put it on a foundation. You've got to put skirting on it. You got to build decks and, you know, put in the driveways and all that sort of stuff. So, it's pretty intensive for sure.
I'm sure managing those amenities is also, it's just like any other single family community.
And like I said, we're not, I mean, I would say in our portfolio, we maybe have 6 or 7 communities that have pools. Obviously, pools can be, you know, somewhat intensive. But other than that, the amenity package is relatively simple. Like I said, we're focused on hardworking families and making amenities for kids. So like building those playgrounds. And once you build them, you know, got to keep the trash cleaned up and make sure the kids aren't abusing them. But other than that, I mean, they're pretty easy to manage.
Well, security, property management, just like, you know, maintaining and stuff. What, like I was at the ULI conference in New York this year, and I was in this SFR panel or council. It's like guesting.
Yep.
A big issue, which I didn't realize. Well, they have like a lot of scattered sites, and it was squatting, people coming and squatting. Do you have any issues with like folks just like squatting? Like what are like what's the legalities behind that? Like, is it the same as just squatting in like a single family house or?
Yeah, no, it definitely can be. And as you know, the states that we're operating in, and we're pretty focused on states where we're able to evict a squatter. I mean, I've owned a lot of homes in California, and through COVID, just had some terrible experiences, like getting somebody out of a home that, you know, they had no right to be in, but for whatever reason, California decided, no, actually, we think they do have rights for your personal property. So, So we can deal with those things, but that really hasn't been a problem for us. And
that's awesome.
I'd say it's mostly because of where we're operating, but also because we're able to, you know, instead of 100 houses spread out all over the place that might be hard to get to and check up on, we can have 100 of them in one community. So if there's anything going on, we've got a property manager. They're on the ground. They're going to, you know, nip it pretty quick.
What sort of capital is attracted to this asset class that you're investing?
So, it's definitely a very kind of middle market strategy. So for Saratoga Group, we have over 450 investors. So that's mostly, you know, people that are writing a $50,000 to $500,000 check. So we've got a lot of those investors. We're moving up the food chain a little bit while still being able to have the decision to hold a community. Like we like to hold. We've sold one of just kind of hold for the long term and have refinances to get capital back and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of, like I said, kind of middle market money attracted to this now, where groups that want to, you know, maybe a private equity group, and they'd like to write a $20 million check or a $15 million check, and that fits pretty well into our space. Bigger ones like Carlyle and Blackstone that you've mentioned that have got into this space, it's harder for them because they've got to go purchase a portfolio for it even to, you know, move the needle at all for them and it makes sense. And because of that, they pay prices, and their capital is cheaper, but it just prices it. The rest of us kind of scratch our heads and like, how does that make sense? But because of their cost of capital, it does. Yeah.
Right. They'll be looking out for you as your portfolio grows and grows.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, they're looking at you. They're looking at you, waiting for you.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Is there a limited supply, or like I studied this asset class as a personal investor years ago,
yeah.
And I was listening to a ton of podcasts about it. They're not building, not, I don't know if you build, but they're not making more of these, right? Is there like a limited supply in the country?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. It's, as you know, supply and demand economics 101, right? It's, you could say, like sitting in my position, being an owner of mobile home parks, it's like, oh, that's great. You know, it's like this moat around our business.
Right.
But it's actually pretty tragic, to be honest, because there you think about, I mean, everybody knows, like we had a presidential debate last night. They never talked about affordable housing, but they should have, because that's such a big issue in our country. And this is a solution that actually works. Nobody seems to want it. They don't want to have it in their backyard. I mean, it's really a local issue. But
is that what it is? Mainly like NIMBY stuff? NIMBYism?
It's mostly NIMBY. Anybody that owns a handful of communities has run into it. I mean, we've had people at different cities that you know, we come in and say, hey, look, we're buying this. We're looking to buy this park, and had responses like, you can buy it if you want, but we're going to shut it down. And it's like, well, hold on. You've got like 150 families living out there. What's your plan for them? Like this, they live right there not because they could afford a whole bunch of other, you know, choices. They're probably living there by necessity, and you want to shut it down. Like, what is your plan, Mr. Planner?
Right. Yeah.
And it's crazy to me. It's crazy to me. But yeah, unfortunately, that's the situation.
Now, I wonder if I watched kind of manufactured housing go from not in my backyard to, wow, there's a $5 million home that's being manufactured and just getting delivered down the street.
Yeah.
And I wonder, with technology, will you be able to get some kind of a mobile home that is crafted by Tesla, and all of a sudden it's like it has a different kind of, even if the cost is efficient, maybe it has a different kind of feel attached to it.
Yeah. No, Lisa, that's a super good point. And I think it's starting to happen a little bit. So you guys are obviously familiar with tiny homes, and it's very interesting how we could go and take, let's say we have an existing community and say, hey, well, we want to put tiny homes in here. The response down at City Hall is like, hey, that'd be great. We'd love that. And it is kind of a perception thing. But unfortunately, tiny homes don't really fit most of, I mean, again, this is families. They need three bedrooms. They need a place for the kids. But that fits some demographics. Like, think of like an affordable senior couple or even a single senior person. Hey, that's a great option, and it's very affordable. But that's the part I get excited about, because I think that in the future, to your point, as Tesla, and there's a lot of other companies working on this, creating a better home or a more efficient home or a higher quality home, but still able to deliver it at a you know, very affordable price point. I love that, because to me, I'm like, well, we're doing the same thing. We've still got these spaces. We'll bring that new home in, and we'll hook it up to these utilities and make it look nice and make it look like part of the neighborhood. And now there's a better product. So I think that's coming, and we're tracking that. And there's certainly groups that are working on it. And it's like anything, there's going to be a few failures before people start getting it right. And that's okay. Yeah.
My uncle, recently retired and moved to a manufactured home on like the bay in Delaware. Right. So it's totally, I don't know. When I was a kid, it was a stigmatism, frankly. Like, it was just the kids that lived in the trailer park.
Yeah.
You know, there's a stigmatism, unfortunately.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, one of my buddies lived there, and so I kind of, you know, you ride your four wheeler over to the trailer park and hang out and cause some trouble. But, you know, it doesn't seem to be like that right now. It seems to be a different sort of, especially like effect, and especially during like recessions, like it. People, like they say, you know, who gets hurt the most during downtimes? It's like the people on the luxury stuff, right? People go to luxury, they go to, you know, then they go to class A. Class A people go to class B. But like, you know, people eventually, you know, at some point go down to the manufactured homes.
That's right.
And then after that, you know, the city officials, where do they go? The shelter, right? Is that one of the reasons you felt like, hey, this is a good asset class to get into?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Chris. So when I, like I said, I'd been doing other kinds of real estate, things that weren't super efficient and things that were very cyclical, right? Where it's like, oh, okay, well, the market's good right now. Let's go do this thing. But that's just exhausting, to be honest. Like, always chasing, okay, now we're in this cycle. Like, now we got to respond this way. And so I was looking for something that was both efficient and would do well in cycles. And, as I was doing some research, I, you know, listened to a bunch of podcasts, read a bunch of things online, and I came across something that indicated that the two big REITs at the time, and there's still the two big ones, Sun Communities and Equity Lifestyle, which is the Sam Zell company, both focused on manufactured housing. At that time, they'd been listed for 18, 19 years, and I read that every single quarter they'd had same store NOI growth quarter over quarter for like 19 years, both of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it was one of them sounds incredible because it's like, you know, it's a dot-com bust, the Great Recession. I mean, all sorts of cycles that have happened. I'm like, that, I don't believe that.
Yeah. It sounds
Madoff
had the same one.
Exactly. But I had my brother-in-law worked on Wall Street, and I was like, hey, can you get me this data? And he was able to track it down for me. And sure enough, it was true. So anyway, that got me pretty excited about it because that's been our experience. I mean, COVID, kid you not, we were very worried, like I think most people in real estate were when, you know, all the shelter in place and everything that kind of happened there. Turns out manufactured housing did really, really well through COVID, even at the beginning, because you've got this shared ownership model where they own the home typically.
Right.
We own the underlying real estate as an owner operator. They're not going to stop paying $400 a month and lose their $45,000 investment. Right. I mean, just so they kept paying. I mean, you know, there's exceptions, and if you have rental homes, then it was harder. But if they own their own home, they were going to keep paying, and we really had very limited exposure for that reason. So
I'm sure they take care of it a lot better than, you know, someone renting an apartment. Like they own it, they own this part of it, so they have home ownership, you know, pride and all that type of stuff, and like with the community, and you know, they take pride in their community and stuff like that.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, good.
Well, I was going to say on that, it's this interesting dynamic with kind of the shared ownership. So a lot of times when we buy a community, even though a lot of people there might own their home already, you drive through and it's like, well, that looks like a trailer park. Like that, there, you don't really see that. You don't see the pride of ownership. But what we find is because we like to hit the ground running. So it's like we close, we'll send out a letter, we're doing tree work within the first 30 days. We're doing paving, you know, shortly after that, we're putting up solar streetlights. I mean, just cleaning up the community, making it brighter, safer, and people respond to that. So it's like when the owner didn't take care of their spot, well, then they're not really taking care of their yard either. And humdrum, here we go. Like, but once we started showing concern and care, they start doing the same thing. It's just awesome to see kind of that happen.
And yeah, that's great.
It's great for the tenant the homeowners, because you have to live with that pride of where you live and that great feeling. It's important.
That's right. And another thing about that is it makes their home that they already bought or are buying more valuable. Because now, right? Because, you know, you never know. I mean, an average owner of a mobile home in a community stays there over 13 years. That's actually longer than people that own a single family home. It's actually longer, maybe by a little bit. But the point is, you know, at some point you're going to sell. We all, right? Typically. And when you do, if you've got a nice community and people want to move in, it's like, well, people are going to want to buy your home, and it's going to make your home more valuable.
Saratoga, how many people work there now? And how did you don't have to get into the, like, how did you build that company from, like, how did you do your first deal? Let's think about you're like, did you go, like, even know where to go? Did you just, like, scour the internet? And, like, what were you looking for? And, like, let's do that first deal.
Chris, I love your questions, both of you. Like, no, this, right? Because I guess I'm like anybody else. I like talking about myself.
It's your favorite subject.
Yeah, it's my favorite subject. No, it's fun to think back. So first property we bought was in California. So I was at that point, I was up in kind of Sacramento area, and we bought a community up there. Funny enough, that's the only one we've sold. But anyway, I wanted something that was relatively close by, and we could make sure we really dug in and knew what we were doing. But from there, again, I already had an organization, so I had accounting staff and you know, a property manager. So I had some things in place there. And so there was kind of a transition there as we wound down single family stuff and started doing more of the mobile home communities. But it was convinced my brother to come on not long after. He was already in Tennessee. And at that point, we were buying in Georgia and Alabama and the Carolinas and stuff like that. And then, you know, just kind of one. We've had some real strategic hires, and that's helped so much. Like we hardest part of building this company, funny enough, was the accounting.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, you know, you wouldn't, but it's like there's so much accounting in real estate, and then it's even more nuanced and complicated in mobile home parks because you've got the homes and kind of construction and all that sort of stuff, plus your, but then you've got the real estate and all these different depreciation schedules, all sorts of fun stuff. So that's been the hardest part. You know, I'll say there, like we have a director of accounting, CFO. Actually, they're both based in California, so we're fully remote. But all the rest of the accounting staff are out of the Philippines. That's been interesting. It's been fantastic. It's worked out very, very well.
This podcast was started with my first producer was in the Philippines.
Really? Okay.
Like
there
five
you go.
Years, 4 or 5 years ago, I hired someone offshore. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was great. It worked out very well.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
do you work
I think
with a company in the Philippines, or do you find the folks there yourself?
Yeah. No. I'm happy to share this because it's been a really interesting journey, and I'm so happy with where we're at now. But initially, we went with another firm who was it was their direct employees, but they were full time for us still. So it was like, you know, it wasn't one of these just where it's like, okay, it's 500 people in a center and you're getting a whole bunch of people part time or whatever. Like we had dedicated people. So we hired two employees through them. And then as we got to know them, we're like, by the way, how much are you getting paid? And they're like,
yeah,
well, I'm getting,
yeah, that question. They don't want to ask that.
Yeah, they're like, well, I'm getting this much. We're like, okay, well, we're paying like double that.
Right.
And we had a certain commitment we had to do. And then as it was over, we're like, well, look, we're going to take that money that we were paying them. We're happy with what we're paying. But we're giving it all to you. I mean, you can imagine how excited they were about that. So right. Then from there, whenever we need a new employee, we just go to our current group right. And we say, hey, here's what we're looking for. You know, and they're all remote as well. They're in different parts of the Philippines. As you know, there's like a whole bunch of islands there, and some of them are on different islands. But they put it out to their network. They get a referral bonus. And we, like, at this point, it is so much easier for us to hire in the Philippines than in the States. That's most of our hiring.
Elisa's a recovering accountant, so she can tell you about that.
Yes, yeah. I'll bet.
Yeah. But long days and long nights. But it's interesting, the concept of outsourcing it like that or having it's interesting because a lot of people feel like they really want their accounting very close to them. So they get nervous about outsourcing it in that way, but it is certainly cost effective. And if you have good folks, that's the dream.
Yeah. 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 No,
so
what's
the trajectory? Like, are you just, I mean, you must feel good about this too, right? I mean, I see you, it must feel good to be able to help people that actually need probably, you know, people living in luxury apartments don't need more luxury. You know what I mean?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
You know, you're putting, you know, you have your lever is whatever, I'm trying to do an analogy here, but you're helping people who need help, most likely.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah,
does it
right.
feel good, too, to be part of that?
Absolutely, Chris. Yeah, and if you don't mind, I might share just kind of related to that. Something we talk about at the company all the time, we call it the bus test. And it actually, we were talking off air about, you know, I grew up in Iowa. And in Iowa, it's like everybody took the bus to school. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
There might have been kids that didn't. I didn't know them. Or I didn't know anybody that didn't take the bus to school. And I can remember getting on, okay, it was when I transitioned from elementary to middle school. So as a sixth grader, getting on to that bus for the first time, you know, skinny little kid with my lunchbox. I was petrified. I was, because it's like, you were going to get beat up or made fun of because you got picked up at the wrong bus stop, or you're wearing the wrong shoes, or
right.
packed the wrong, you know what I mean? That's like a...
Your mere existence.
Yeah. It's a rough environment. And so we, you know, we think about that with our communities as far as kids are getting dropped off in front of our community or getting picked up from school in front of our community. And it's like, are they embarrassed? Are they embarrassed because of where they live? Or did we clean it up and we put in a nice bus stop and it's raining, they're able to stand at the bus stop while they're waiting. They have a nice, you know, it's cleaned up. There's brand new roads. They can, you know, they get off school, they can ride their bikes around or skateboards or whatever. And so we that's what we call it, bus test. And it's like,
I like that. If
you drive by the community and the kids are getting out of the bus, like, do they have their heads hanging down, or are they happy to be home and feel like it's a, you know, it's home and it's a place where they can be proud of and not ashamed of.
I love that. That's so cool.
I love that too.
My kid walks
so
to school, so he doesn't have a bus stop.
I'm sorry, say that again.
My son walks to school, so he doesn't have a bus stop. But I had a bus stop. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish we had an overhang. I was in New Jersey. We had the rain and the snow. My hair was freezing. You know, you could pick up at 6:30 in the morning and just take a shower. My hair froze.
I was thinking the same thing. I grew up in Brooklyn, and I would take public buses, but I had the bus pass. And I feel like there was no overhang. They didn't care. You were cold. It was raining. It was snowing. Whatever it was.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's a typical experience, I think.
Well, Sam, really appreciate you coming on here. We've just been warming you up here. But now it's going to get extremely, extremely caliente, because you have just entered the hot seat.
Well, that's why I'm squirming around here.
I see sweat pouring. Yeah. We're not recording this video, but there's sweat pouring down his face right now. Lisa, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'll start with my favorite question, which is, do you have a book or a podcast recommendation? Because when I get off these, I always have great recommendations.
Yeah. I listen to a lot of podcasts that are kind of specific to my industry. So, but I'll tell you, like, right now I just started a book, and it was because I was listening to a podcast. It's called Building an Elite Organization. I think it's by Don Wenner. He's the founder of DLP Capital. Uh-huh. And I'm halfway through it. I am jazzed about what I'm learning there, because I feel like he's kind of taking all these different business principles from Jim Collins, Good to Great, and John Maxwell, and a whole bunch of these other people, and putting it in basically, okay, here's how you implement this in a fast-growing entrepreneurial company. I'm like, okay, that's what I'm looking for right there. Like, I'm really excited about it. And so that's the book. Like I said, I haven't even finished. I'm like halfway through it, but it's been great so far.
That's awesome. Yeah, I haven't read that one.
It's on the list now.
I'm sure awesome. It's on. Yeah, it's gonna be on the Flickr list. Which we should put out one day, by the way.
Cool.
I find people who have a lot of responsibility, a lot of things moving around in their lives, often have a set routine or something, some sort of routine that they do. Like for me, like I meditate, I run, I have certain things in my life that like I need to do those things, because everything else can be so chaotic, right?
Yeah.
Do you have a set routine or any sort of morning practice or anything along those lines?
So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I have a group of guys, we play basketball really early in the morning.
Nice.
So I'm up at 4:40 to, like, you know, kind of jam out the door and go and do that. And I look forward to that. Other than that, I wish I spent more time, you know, like you said, meditating and I do some of that. A lot of that happens with the family though, almost in more like in the evening when the kids are awake and that sort of thing. We'll kind of take some time like after dinner, to kind of have some quiet time together. But anyway, yeah, that's kind of the morning routine, is getting up and exercising and having fun doing it.
I saw it was actually funny on LinkedIn. Like I said, the happiest people I know are slowing down, not speeding up. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's great.
Because I'm like, I got to do more.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why am I doing all this stuff?
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Like, what's the bigger purpose here?
Right. And you start to realize that if you keep your calm and you kind of go through your process and do the things you need to do, things just fall into place. That chaos actually hurts, doesn't help usually.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I agree.
Exactly.
It doesn't stop me from living in that chaos, but I do know in my wise mind that that is the truth.
Intellectually, it sounds great.
Yeah, yeah, that's
exactly
right.
Exactly, exactly. So it sounds like you've hired a lot of different people throughout your time here. Are there any things in particular that you look for when you're hiring an employee?
You know, I wish I had my head of HR on for this, because I didn't do very well hiring before I had her, to be totally candid. And she's so good. But I can tell you, it's a lot about the culture. And it's a lot about finding, well, here's another book, Extreme Ownership by Jocko, and I can't remember it. But like, that's what we're looking for. That is our culture. Like, we're trying to stay very entrepreneurial, and like, there's no micromanagement. Like, hey, here's right. You know, what we need done, do it when you can and as efficiently as you can. If you can do it in 20 hours a week, kudos to you. So that, you know, we're just kind of looking for self-driven folks that need a little bit of framework. And, you know, the other side of that is we have some deficiencies, I think, in kind of training people, and because we're so much to that other side. So we're trying to fix those now. And that's actually why I'm reading the book that I mentioned.
Yeah. And Lisa's actually really great at systems and all that stuff. She's a great, we have a bunch of junior folks, and she's like, when she joined the firm, it was like all of a sudden they had somebody that was like willing to put in the time and the effort, and she's really good at it. Like,
that's awesome.
I'm not so as good at it. I'm good at like being next to Lisa while she does it.
The problem is, I think of all of these, my kids both just are leaving for college. I feel like now I think of all the people on our team as my own children. So I have to not, you know,
there you go.
I internalize it. My kids are like, you know, they're not your children. I'm like, they kind of are.
Yeah. There's some responsibility there. Yeah. We're big on, you know, mentors and like people that, you know, we don't do this alone. Mentors have had the most impact on your life and career?
That's a great question. I've definitely had a number of mentors in this mobile home park space specifically. A couple of them that are veterans leading or have led or are leading large organizations, much, much bigger than what we are. And they've been super helpful to me. But I think when I consider maybe someone that's had the most impact for me, it would be a gentleman by the name of Dean Foreman, who successful in business, but that, like, that's not even the first thing I think of when I think of him, because he's like the holistic mentor. He's got a great family life, and he's got, you know, kind of a beautiful culture that he's created there. Just kind of his spiritual journey and his, he was able to basically walk away from his business. And it's like, instead of going and sitting on the beach, he founded this private school. This is in California, in the Sacramento area. It's called John Adams Academy, and it's like completely blowing up. And I think they've got four or five facilities now. You know, teaching kids about like the founding fathers and constitutional principles. And anyway, like,
what's his name?
His name is Dean Foreman. O-R.
Look him up. And
yeah, fantastic. Fantastic.
We need more people like that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So he's really been very influential for me in my life.
That's awesome. Well, Sam, really great to get to know you better. Congrats on all your success. I love what Saratoga is doing, and the mobile home park space is a great, you know, as an investment, it seems like a pretty great investment, but also as an impact on the world, it seems like you're out doing some good for the country. So thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris and Lisa.
And I love the bus test, the bus stop test. That will remain in my mind forever, because it's great.